You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Mary Margaret Slack toku ingoa, no mahaere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā, kia ora everyone. Welcome to The Wire for Tuesday the 25th of September. I'm your host Mary Margaret and I'll be with you for the next hour with my croaky voice. But we've got some booming loud voices as well. We've got Connor and Justin here. Mm-hmm. Hello.
Hello.
How are you guys today?
Very well.
I'm good. I'm very excited for today's
Wire. Yeah.
Considering I've put almost 2 weeks of effort into this one.
Good on you. Jam-packed show today. We've got Auckland's TEDx event for 2018 is coming up, so I'm talking to their creative director and one of the speakers about what to expect. As Justin just said, the fourth he's doing an exciting story today on the fourth anniversary of a Hong Kong democratic protest, and he's speaking to a social activist who headed the movement and also a former pro-democrat lawmaker. Yes?
Yep, both. Cool.
Very exciting. Over in England, the Conservative Party could call another general election in the UK. So Connor has given us a rundown on what's happening there.
Yeah, so we're going to kind of start from the beginning with Brexit because everyone goes on about how no one knows what's going on. I didn't know what was going on until about 2 hours ago. now I know, and I want to let all you know what's going on today.
Very exciting. And finally, for the Green Desk this week, we're looking at Inspiring Explorers, a program that's getting Kiwis on Antarctic adventures. Hea ha o whakaro, get in touch with us with any thoughts that you have, because I love to hear from you. Tuku pātuhi mai, you can text us on 5395 or Waiamai. Give us a call on 309 3879.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Auckland's annual TEDx event is coming up in a few weeks, so I spoke to the creative director, Ethan Alderson Hughes, about what's in stock for this year. One speaker is Hemi Kelly, who published a book, A Māori Word a Day, earlier this year. Hemi also joined us to talk about how TEDx provides a platform for ideas that exist outside of the mainstream. I started by asking Ethan to explain what TEDx is.
TEDx is an independently run TED event. So it's not run by the big TED brand, but any person from any city could get the license for it and organise their own event within the brand guidelines, but also add their own kind of creative spin to it.
Mm. And what the event involves, speakers who talk about?
Yeah, it involves speakers sharing what I guess you'd call unique ideas that the person curating the speakers believes to be worth sharing, but it's also a food event. You know, there's heaps of food vendors and drinks and music and just general networking. Like, you get to actually meet the speakers.
Mm. It's a platform.
It's an event, and then it's a platform within that.
Sure.
Yeah.
So when and how did it come to Auckland?
Well, it was actually here in, I think it was 2010. It was first here, but the current licensee picked it up in 2012, and that's Elliot Blade, and he's run with it since 2012.
Mm. Does it change when it comes to New Zealand at all? Like, do we put our own little spin on it, or?
I think that's just kind of pretty natural for any city that picks up the TEDx brand, because you do want to put yourself into it in some way. In particular for, I think, any of the New Zealand TEDx's. Auckland is not the only one.
Oh, okay.
A big part of it is te reo, so you can look at most of the TEDx's around New Zealand, and there's a lot of te reo in their marketing and in the topics that they speak about.
Good.
Yeah. So I think it's just like pretty natural to put your own identity into these
make it
things.
Unique.
Well, also because it's the community, like the community around you is coming together. So of course, that's going to just kind of come out.
Yeah,
in
and
the
they'll
platform.
Shape it in any way that they can. So when it comes to Auckland this year, is there anything particularly special about this event or a theme or something that you're going for? Like, what's sort of the direction?
Yeah, so we don't always do a theme, but this year we've direction's a good choice of word, because the theme is off-piste, which is a ski term meaning to go, you know, off the conventional track.
Right.
And we've kind of gone for that in our marketing of this event. For people that haven't seen it, it's these circles that say off-piste on it, but whatever is in the circle changes. So we've used a lot of local artists, local Auckland artists,
cool,
who have come in and given us, been very generous and given us like amazing art.
Yeah. Will that be on display at the event?
Yes. And it's all over the internet now as well in our marketing. And yeah,
it is the way these days.
That's been pretty exciting to like bring that side of Auckland into it as well. And the theme off-piste has allowed us to do that.
Because, that's very cool.
Yeah, well we can stamp the brand onto it and adhere to the brand guidelines, but also bring in whatever artwork and stuff we want to at the same time.
Yeah. Well, as you bring up the brand guidelines, we were talking before about how it's a non-profit organisation and people don't usually know that.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess it's because the TED brand is so well recognised that people don't actually realize that it's a non-profit when it's a TEDx organized event. So we mostly run on volunteer work, lot like BFM does, but I also think people don't really realize that it's non-profit because of like how good it looks and how professional, I guess, and all these really hard-working volunteers. I mean, the artists that gave us the themes for off-piste just donated their art.
Yeah. You
know? So it totally relies on amazing, hard-working volunteers.
For sure.
Right down to the editing of the videos as well.
Right. And grants.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have to basically rely on grants, sponsorship from partners, donated food for the event, food and drink from great vendors, and then volunteers who come in and
sort of an event of kindness in a way.
Yeah, and I think maybe TED just the TEDx just kind of naturally draws people to it, like people that have that kind of mindset to it.
Yeah. So, moving to you, Hemi, how did you sort of find out about TEDx and want to become involved with it?
I've known TEDx for a while now. I've been a fan of TEDx and watching TEDx throughout the years. I think it was towards the start of this year that conversation started with Ethan and Elliot about the possibility of standing on the TEDx stage and presenting an idea that I'm really passionate about.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's coincided this year with you publishing your book, A Māori Word a Day.
Yeah, it has, A Māori Word a Day, published in February. And I suppose my talk, my idea is connected to the idea of A Māori Word a Day, using A Māori Word a Day.
Yeah.
Which was a nice coincidence.
Yeah. And so do you want to tell us a little bit about how the book and that idea kind of started that journey?
It's... In a nutshell, at the moment, I think we can all acknowledge that there's this shift happening with Te Reo Māori in the country, which is quite evident throughout the community and especially on mainstream television. Mm-hmm. And in other places, we can see this is happening. So I talked to what we're witnessing, and I really extend the invitation to anyone who's not actively involved in that movement or that shift to move into this space, and talk to a few things that might inhibit or hinder some people from wanting to be involved. There's three main points there that I talk to. So that's the real gist of the idea of the conversation. Yeah.
And I guess in terms of connecting with the theme, it's like that's outside of the mainstream, but soon it won't be, and making that transition happen.
Yeah, that's right. Like I envisage this circle where all this stuff is going on, but there's people on the periphery of that circle who aren't yet quite involved but want to be involved. So talking to everyone, but in particular those people.
It's an exciting time, sensitive but exciting. I was going to ask about how you were also a part of the Writers Festival this year, which is actually where me and Ethan met. So, so I guess another aspect of the increasing movement to bring Te Reo Māori into the public conscience. Where do you think we take that now? Like, what comes next?
I think there's this gradual momentum that's building, and it has been building for some time now. I think it's really exciting to think about where we'll be in the next, say, 5, 10, even 20 years.
Yeah.
Just looking back at how far we've come in the last 5 years.
Exactly.
So who knows exactly where we'll be, but I think that gradual momentum will just continue to build if we continue to be involved with this movement, I suppose, with this change. Yeah, it is a change, with the social shift that we're witnessing.
And I think it's cool because, yeah, we don't know what will happen in 10 or 20 years, but we create that.
Mm-hmm.
And so by doing things like that, we can envision what it will be in 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you guys want to sort of finish, like, any final comments about the theme as a whole and how your sort of ideas connect into that?
I'm just really privileged to be given this opportunity to stand on such a recognised stage and present an idea that's really passionate to me, alongside others who are talking about some amazing, amazing things.
Yeah.
That's the great thing about being involved with TEDx so far, is being able to meet the people who run the event, and also the other speakers. There's a real community about the whole event, which I wasn't aware of before getting into TEDx. I thought you just kind of get on the stage and talk, but there's a whole process before you get to that point, which is really amazing thing to be a part of.
Yeah, it's good.
It's not very sterile. It's a very friendly environment. Even when Hemi first pitched, I mean, I approached Hemi, but Hemi still pitched, and even that was, you know, at a bar.
Yeah,
it's a collaboration.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the other speakers as well?
Oh man! Oh god!
As if Hemi's so wasn't a teaser enough about the event.
There's so much to talk about, actually. Everyone's exploring a new idea.
Okay.
Nothing really crosses over, other than the fact that they're all pretty interesting and unique.
Yeah.
But anyone can go and look at the lineup, and you're going to find somebody in there that is really going to resonate with you.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
That was Ethan Alderson-Hughes and Hemi Kelly. And TEDx will be taking place on Saturday the 13th of October. You can find tickets for it at tedxauckland.com. You can also get a student discount if you send a photo of your student ID when you purchase tickets. We'll be right back after this. Here's Dialing a Prayer by Straightjacket Fitz.
December 8th at the Power Station. 95BFM presents Straightjacket Fitz and Dimmer. We'll be right back.
present Anderson .Paak. Yeah. January 12th at the Logan Campbell Centre. One in the hand, one in the bag. With Dr. Dre just done putting the final polish on his hotly anticipated third album, Anderson .Paak is overflowing with energy and headed back to NZ. Anderson .Paak with support from Napalm. January 12th at the Logan Campbell Centre. Tickets on sale Wednesday from livenation.co.nz.
Are you healthy and not on any medication? Auckland Clinical Studies is looking for males and females aged between 18 and 55 years for a new clinical trial. You need to be in good health, not on any medication, and commit to 4-night in-house stays and some short follow-up appointments. You'll be paid for your time and travel expenses. Text ACS followed by your email address to 244 and Auckland Clinical Studies will email you the study information today. Standard charges apply.
Playing two barnstorming shows in Auckland. The Johnnies, this Saturday at Galazos and this Sunday at Lee Sawmill.
Darling, listen, we'll cut the others down the side.
Trailblazing, rough riding, indisputable champions of cowpunk.
It's gonna be a showdown.
The Johnnies with special guests, the Bags. This Saturday at Galazos and this Sunday at Lee Sawmill. Tickets from under the radar.
It's your Kiwaha o Te Wiki, your saying of the week. This week,
Kei Tua o Tā Wauwau, away with the fairies.
Yo, you coming to lunch? Oi, are you even listening?
Huh? Oh, mate, Kei Tua o Tā Wauwau, aho. Didn't sleep much last night, sorry.
Ha! You're something else, my mate. Let's start with a coffee.
Kei Tua o Tā Wauwau, away with the fairies.
It's your Kiwaha o Te Wiki, brought to you by Ngā Tauira Māori, the University of Auckland Māori Students Association.
Irirangi Pōho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
What's up, Justin?
So, yeah, so Friday, the 28th of September, will be one of the most iconic things that happened in Hong Kong history, the fourth anniversary of the Umbrella Revolution or Occupy Central in Hong Kong. Basically, what's happened is people going occupied parts of Hong Kong's political center to fight for democracy. But I will be going through that in my thing, and which starts now.
Dramatic scenes in Hong Kong overnight, with authorities taking a tough line.
September 28th, 2014. This is the day that Hong Kong changed forever. But what leads to the day? I'm going to provide you some context first. Hong Kong's top official, the chief executive, is not democratically elected. It is currently chosen by a 1,200-member election committee made up of representatives from four sectors with 300 members each. The 300 members of each sectors are then divided into groups which represent different professions. For example, under the industrial, commercial and financial sector, its subsectors included catering, hotel, tourism and real estate. However, it is near impossible for grassroots Hong Kongers to become representatives of their own profession, which I'll demonstrate using some subsectors. When I mention the catering industry, you might think of the people who are chefs, waiters or even dishwashers can choose their representatives. That's not the case. The reality is, only those who hold food licenses or members of big catering management associations can choose who will be on the committee. And on the finance subsector, instead of bank tellers or accountants, the industry's representatives are chosen by corporate votes. The bosses of the 156 corporate bodies that are banks and deposit-taking companies. Since its implementation in 1998, the committee has been compared to a black box, as its composition heavily favoured those pro-Beijing and has business interests. Pan-Democrats for years have campaigned to abolish the committee and establish universal suffrage to elect the chief executive. By January 2013, there were already plans to use radical means to bring universal suffrage to Hong Kong. The movement, named Occupy Central with Love and Peace, was founded by three people, Benny Tai, Chu Yuming, and Chan Kim Man. It proposed an act of civil disobedience be carried out in Central, the business and financial district of Hong Kong, if the government failed to announce reforms introducing genuine universal suffrage.
The movement's manifesto stated that it will campaign for universal suffrage through dialogue, deliberation, civil referendum, and civil disobedience. It also demanded that any government proposal should satisfy international standards in relation to universal suffrage, such as equal number of votes, equal weight of each vote, and no unreasonable restrictions on the right to stand for election, and the final proposal for electoral reform be decided by a means of a genuine democratic process. The founders also emphasized their objective of non-violent civil disobedience.
市民的認同，亦都希望增加咗一種嘅政治壓力。咁而依個係如果係能夠，Tai
says the movement uses self-sacrificing to win support from the public, which would give them a mandate, and by occupying the streets of Hong Kong's financial center, would apply political pressure to mainland China and force them to go to the negotiating table. In late 2013, the Hong Kong government announced a reform on choosing the chief executive, which aimed to allow all Hong Kong voters to vote for the chief executive in the next election in 2017. However, on August 31st, 2014, a decision made by the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress, which is the legislative body of mainland China, set limits for the political reform. The decision states that candidates for the chief executive has to, quote, love the country and Hong Kong, to guarantee that a nominating committee modelled on the current election committee system will be formed to nominate two or three candidates, each of whom must receive the support of more than half of the members of the nominating committee. Democrats are enraged by the proposed reforms and called it a, quote, fake universal suffrage.
中央干預越來越多，好似免費電視牌照事件，立法會應否調查梁振英，中聯辦都要插手。Alan
Leong of the Pan-Democrat Civic Party says the reforms are causing Hong Kong to go backwards because the requirements under the new nomination committee will be more stricter than the current system, which makes it harder for potential Democrats to enter the race. They proposed nominating candidates using civil nomination, which candidates who receive a quota of nominations from ordinary voters will be allowed to run in the election. However, then Hong Kong Chief Executive CY Leung's government and other pro-Beijing individuals welcomed Beijing's decision. Then Chief Secretary Carrie Lam claims the reforms have improved Hong Kong's political situation. By having 5 million voters choosing the chief executive instead of a 1,200-strong committee, she also blames the alternatives proposed by Democrats have, quote, deepened differences and damaged the trust between Hong Kongers. Regina Ip, a lawmaker from the pro-Beijing New People's Party and notoriously known for trying to implement mainland security law in 2003 when she was the Secretary for Security, says universal suffrage only ensures that every voter their right to vote and the process is fair, but not the right to nominate candidates. University and secondary school students also protested against Beijing's decision by boycotting classes. The campaign, jointly organized by the Hong Kong Federation of Students and secondary student activist group Scholarism, was participated by university students from the 22nd to 26th of September and also by secondary school students on the 26th of September. The movement demanded the National People's Congress retract its decision made on the 31st of August, Chief Executive CY Leung to restart the political reform process and propose a system that reflects what most Hong Kongers want. At the night of the 26th, leading student activists Joshua Wong, Alex Chow and Nathan Law scaled the fence and entered the forecourt of the east wing of the Hong Kong's government headquarters, known more commonly as the Civic Square. Police cleared the square next day and arrested 60 people, including the three leaders. During the day, the situation continued to escalate as other protesters started to arrive at government headquarters and skirmishes with police began. This is the police clashing with protesters in a nearby overhead bridge to government headquarters. At 1:38 a.m. on the 28th of September, Benny Tai announced the Occupy Central movement is in full effect. Tai says the student boycott campaign is Hong Kong's biggest civil disobedience movement, and the occupation will start at Tin Mei Avenue, the street next to government headquarters. Tai also says the movement has started a new age in Hong Kong's history, which he describes as the age of resistance, and urged others to go to the area to support the movement. Around 4 p.m. on the 28th, the footpaths of Harcourt Road, the main road in front of government headquarters, could no longer contain the large numbers of demonstrators who were streaming to the location in support of those facing police pressure on Tin Mei Avenue. They spilled onto the busy road and traffic came to a stop. And at 6 p.m, riot police fired tear gas into the crowd. This is the first time since the handover to China that tear gas has been used in Hong Kong. However, nearly 50,000 protesters refused to disperse and they occupied Harcourt Road and neighbouring Connaught Road. Protesters in other areas such as Mong Kok and Causeway Bay also occupied roads. The occupied areas remain closed to traffic for 77 days. Despite numerous incidents of violence by triads and thugs, particularly in the Mong Kok region, and other several attempts by the police to clear the area, protesters held their ground for over 2 months. After the Mong Kok occupation area was cleared on the 25th of November, the government headquarters and Causeway Bay occupied areas were also cleared with no opposition on the 11th and 14th of December, respectively. The political reform itself was expected not to pass in the Legislative Council because the results was expected to be 41 votes in favour to 28 votes opposed, 6 votes from a required 2/3 absolute majority. But what happened during the day of the vote was an embarrassment to the pro-Beijing camp. Right before the vote, 33 pro-Beijing legislators walked out to wait for a member so he could cast his vote. 8 of their colleagues did not follow suit, and with all 28 pan-democrats present, the quorum of 35 was met in the House. Therefore, the reform was defeated in a landslide by 8 votes in favour to 28 votes opposed. The Occupy Central movement has changed Hong Kong forever. The rift between different political camps diverged, and new political ideas on Hong Kong's relations with China emerged. But why? And what does that mean? I first talked to Agnes Chow, a member of Demasisto, a political group evolved from scholarism. She was a spokesperson for scholarism during the Occupy Central movement and tried to run for a Legislative Council seat earlier this year, but her nomination was disqualified because the government has deemed her beliefs illegal. I asked her what's next for her party.
We'll not see ourselves as our political party anymore, but a political organization. We're not aiming at running at election and getting seats in the electoral anymore, but we're trying to do a lot of work, political work, and promotions on different issues and policies that we think unjust. For example, the national anthem law that the Legislative Council is probably discussing within this year that is kind of limiting the right of kind of the free of speech and the right to express their opinion. So we are doing actually a lot of promotions on the National Anthem Law, and also we are showing our concern on different national education related issues, and we are checking on different textbooks that we think are problematic or with problematic content or kind of patriotic content. So although we couldn't run for election, but we believe that in our position we can still do a lot of work in telling Hong Kong people that there are lots of problematic issues or policies proposing by the government.
I also talked to Dr. Kenneth Chan, a former Hong Kong lawmaker for the Civic Party and a current associate professor in the Department of Government and International Studies at the Hong Kong Baptist University. I asked him, could the Democrats and localists have room to cooperate?
Well, at the end of the day, the democracy movement is a broad church. And no one should be in the position to say who is definitely not or who's definitely right or who's definitely wrong. I think we, again, as I said, we've learned the hard lessons over the past decade or so. And now if anybody's trying to say that, oh, you know, I'm the only way or I'm the only correct way, I think they are not really being honest about the cruel realities. So I very much hope that whatever branding, whatever logo, or whatever banner members of the pro-democracy movement would like to be seen to be affiliated with, the clear line of division is actually between us and them, us being Hong Kongers fighting for Hong Kong's democracy and autonomy and rights, them being the autocrats under the Xi Jinping regime. So this division is the most important division. It's a political division, and underneath there can be different shades, diversity, but I think there could be unity in diversity, and that might serve Hong Kong better that way.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Yes, and the interview between Agnes Chow and Dr. Kenneth Chan is only like a minute, and the whole interview will be on BCast later.
Yeah. Yeah. If you head there after the show, you can get the full story because Justin put a lot of work into that.
Yeah. Mm. And yeah, just yesterday, the Hong Kong National Party. The Hong Kong National Party, is a party who advocated for Hong Kong independence, was officially banned by the Hong Kong government as an illegal organization because of what they talked, because what they believe, and yeah.
It's I read into that, and it's a very, they're using kind of dated colonial like laws from the 19th century that are still on the books under the basic law.
That law was supposed to be used in the 1970s to regulate triads and thugs, but today it has been used to regulate to ban opposition political parties that the government don't hold the same ideas, instead of banning triads that cause violence and crime in Hong Kong, which is really no idea what they are thinking about.
Anti-democratic.
Very anti-democratic.
I think another thing, just finally from me at least, to bear in mind for the listeners who kind of forget or don't know, there is a kind of sense of urgency with this democratic movement to get these freedoms through, because mark your calendars, July 2047 is the day that the one country, two systems stops and China takes over Hong Kong fully. So no more basic law, no more Sino-British declaration that should stop political parties being banned, that Thatcher signed in the 80s when we were British handing over Hong Kong. None of that. It will be up to Hong Kong people to decide their democratic fate.
Yeah, and the national anthem law that Agnes Chow just talked about in her interview.
She's impressive.
Very impressive. Mm. Yeah. And yeah, that law is just writing in black and white that you telling people you must respect the national anthem, like you must stand or you go to prison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Thanks, Justin.
No worries.
Ko te wai, tēnei maronga BFM, you are on 95BFM. And in our next story, what's happened, Connor?
Well, there have been updates on Brexit.
Yeah.
There have been serious updates on Brexit.
Cool.
So what I was going to do is, as I said at the top of the show, no one knows what's going on. Like, no, seriously, no one. No, even Parliament sort of only have about 50% of an idea of what's going on.
Sure.
So I've kind of been going through documents and news articles and what have you, and I've got not a complete idea, but as a closer idea than before. Something that gives you the general rough outline of what's going on.
Okay.
And the sort of the wider context of this. So the first thing is, you might be wondering, all of you know, listeners out there, why was the UK and the EU in the first place? Because it never actually seemed like they wanted to be there. And the reason why it was is because back in when the UK signed up to it in the 1970s, the UK was bankrupt. It was the kind of sick economy of Europe. Like, a lot of economies in Europe suffered with decolonization.
Okay.
Because you think about when you have colonies all over the world, you're getting a massive amount of revenue in, and that just suddenly stops overnight with independence. So, which meant that the countries went into a huge amount of debt. So they basically had to come together. The UK was forced to come together into the common market because they couldn't guarantee the security of selling to markets like Australia or New Zealand or India or Jamaica or anything like that, on the off chance that those countries would decide they actually didn't want anything to do with the UK anymore, and then the UK's kind of out on their own. So they had to go into it, and in the process it was kind of worked for the Labour Party at the time, because their attitude was kind of bigger Europe, smaller empire, which was basically turning around to Australia, New Zealand and India and basically saying, you're part of a horrible past we'd like to forget and we don't want anything to do with you anymore. Which is something that's very contentious in the UK, and is very contentious here, and there's actually still not just in New Zealand but a lot of Australians and Indians.
Well, yeah, of
and
course.
Are very,
because
you know,
that's an ineffective way to address it.
Because it basically just screwed the agricultural industry here for, well, sent it into free fall for about a year until it finally, New Zealand found and Australia found other markets. Anyway, went into that. They got special deal. The UK got a special deal with immigration where you had to show ID cards. They still weren't happy. They had a special deal with keeping their currency, the pound, because it was one of the strongest in Europe. They still weren't happy with that. Basically, it all came to free movement. A lot of people who subscribed to Farage good, foreigners bad, went out to vote in 2016 after this. The idea of leaving the EU had been floated quite a few times, and the vote came in 51.89% in favour of leaving the EU. And that was when the UK was kind of at an all-time high. It had gone from the 70s point of being in a massive amount of debt to being fifth or sixth largest economy in the world.
Right.
So they didn't really need the EU like they did before to get goods into the common market and rah-de-rah-de-rah. So David Cameron obviously resigned, being a Remain supporter, because he basically, the first thing he did when he actually gained a majority in Parliament was screw it all up by giving it away in an EU referendum. Theresa May came in and took the leadership under a divided party. Corbyn came in, did exactly the same thing. And then we had the election in 2017 that was kind of meant to be the it's almost meant to be a second Brexit referendum. It was meant to be like, do we want to go with the pro-Leave party, the Tories, or do we want to go with the Remain party,
Labour? So your vote for a party kind of indicated your leanings on Brexit.
Sort of, yeah, okay. When we actually realised what Brexit meant. What it meant was, how that election turned out was Theresa May, who basically treated the election as a foregone conclusion, went into it saying strong and stable leadership, I've got this, basically. Lost her majority and had to form a coalition with the Northern Irish DUP, who were pro keeping an open Irish border. So that was another headache in the Brexit thing for her. Jeremy Corbyn ended up kicking out the Blairites, so he gained more control over his party. Just to give you an idea of how much the Tories lost that kind of informal referendum, the Canterbury constituency in Kent had been Tory since 1910 until last year. So that's how much, there was a backlash against the Labour Party.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, kind of from this point on, that kind of set the tone for May's prime ministership. The vultures have been circling for a while. The party's kind of been unable to agree on most of the fine details. And when May won her agreement from the cabinet to pursue a free trade area between the UK and the EU, she saw David Davis, who's the Brexit secretary, and Boris Johnson, the foreign secretary, both hand in resignations, with Johnson saying, and I quote, the UK was heading for the status of a colony. Yeah, he said that. The current events have been defined kind of by the customs union debacle, essentially. The customs union proposal basically keeps the UK in a trade union with the EU, meaning trade won't be hindered by a whole range of new barriers, meaning you don't have endless lines of lorries sitting on the motorways, you don't have ships going through endless checks, you don't have goods that suddenly aren't allowed to come into the UK or have to see massive price hikes, that sort of thing. Problem is that the Brexiteers didn't want that either. They thought that we could get it cheaper from the Commonwealth or create our own products to replace the stuff coming with Europe from Europe. But it passed nonetheless, and then there was even more division. Then there was the Chequers plan, which literally only a few days ago just got knocked down by the EU. Now that plan would have seen a common rule book for all goods going to and from the EU. It would have seen a treaty with the Republic of Ireland separate from the EU to continue the open border, the frictionless border and the trade agreement. Parliament would have the liberty to diverge from EU rules when required, and the agreement would allow the UK to control trade tariffs with other nations without attracting EU tolls. So basically means that, say, the foreign minister for New Zealand that wants to sign a free trade agreement with New Zealand, with the UK, New Zealand beef being imported into the UK wouldn't attract an extra tax from the European Union. It would only be subject to whatever regulations went on between New Zealand or the UK government. Problem is the EU negotiators, half her party, and the Irish and the Spanish governments disagreed with it. This kind of left her trapped by her party divisions with kind of little command over a really divided Commons and no deal for Brexit. So only a week ago, The Times leaked a memo with the Tory cabinet outlining a plan to oust May, listing potential successors. Thankfully, Jacob Rees-Mogg and Johnson weren't included, but David Davis and Amber Rudd was. And I don't know how Amber Rudd would be in the Windrush scandal.
Amber Rudd is very Theresa May-like.
Yeah, she kind of is, and during her time with Home Secretary and cutting police and allowing terrorist radicals to kind of thrive, basically the point is that happened, and then now only a day ago there's just been announced that we might be going into a snap election in November.
So how many would that be in the last year?
The third straight UK-wide national poll in 3 years.
Yeah,
right.
One for each year,
giving Australia a run for their money at the moment in terms of prime ministers. Basically, what it means is it's going to mean that it's just going to be a consolidation of leadership. It's going to mean, do we want to? It's basically going to air out all that division in the Conservative Party. So it's either going to be people get sick of the Conservative Party for infighting and they go Labour. If Jeremy Corbyn can pull it together and actually tell us his stance on Brexit, which he still hasn't yet, basically it gives people a opportunity to vote for clear and decisive leadership instead of having a party with two divided wings who won't speak to each other, who can't even pass the most basic legislation through.
Right.
So, yeah. And all of this in light of 29th of March being Brexit Day.
Yeah.
So by 29th of March, if we don't have anything sorted with the EU, we're crashing out with, we are up a certain creek without a certain paddle.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Lots to come on that story, eh?
Yes.
Well,
posted.
Whakaronga tonu mai, stay tuned. We'll be right back after these messages.
Teenage Fan Club are all grown up and coming back to New Zealand. If you want to jump on the bandwagon, then just stay tuned to 95BFM all this week for your chance to win tickets. But you've got to have a Simplicity V card. BFM presents Teenage Fan Club, Monday, February 18th at the Power Station. Tickets on sale Monday, August 27th from Ticketmaster.
Hakarongo mai, it's Māori words, because he waka eke noa, te atahua hoki. That's beautiful.
Happy anniversary, I made a picture of us with macaroni.
Oh babe, te atahua hoki, I love it.
You're the one with the gold spray paint.
Can't buy it, babe. cowboy.
That's beautiful. Te atahua hoki. Māori words. Karawhiua. Give it a go.
Kia tau te rangi Māori e. O rangi nui e tui honei. O papu tuanuku e takatonei. O te tai ao e awhinei I a tātou. Tihei Māori ora. This is The Green Desk on 95BFM.
This week on The Green Desk, Jack is speaking with James Harding from the Antarctic Heritage Trust. For the past few years, the Trust has run an outreach program called Inspiring Explorers, which takes everyday Kiwis on adventures to Antarctic mountains and the freezing wilderness. Jack asked Harding about exactly what the Trust does and how one of us can go on one of these adventures.
So the Antarctic Heritage Trust is all about inspiring explorers. We care for the expedition bases of the early Antarctic explorers, including Captain Robert Falcon Scott, Sir Ernest Shackleton, Sir Edmund Hillary, and a guy called Carsten Borchgrevink, who's perhaps a name that's not as familiar as those other ones. But he was a Norwegian who actually led the first expedition to winter over in Antarctica, and his huts at Cape Adare actually the only example of humanity's first building left on any continent. So we care for the bases that these amazing explorers left behind, as well as the 20,000 artefacts that are contained in those bases. And in addition to our conservation work, we run expeditions with an aim of connecting young people with this legacy of exploration that we care for.
Yeah, that's wild. I was thinking about that kind of fact, that this is like the first, it's like the,
yeah,
it's on the a first, continent.
That's right, yeah. So these guys, they brought their ship down the Southern Cross in the late 19th century, and they kind of set up camp at this remote spit called Cape Adare, which is the home to something like 750 Adelie penguins. I think it's the biggest Adelie penguin rookery in the world, and it's known for kind of 200-kilometre-an-hour winds, and they decided that was the place to set up their huts. And those huts are still standing today, and they're part of that legacy that we care for.
Yeah, no, I'm just even like contemplating what those early explorers went there for. Why did they go there? Just out of curiosity. It doesn't seem like a very hospitable place.
Yeah, I think it was just that sense of, exploring these final frontiers, and kind of in a way that the polar regions were. They were sort of the last, the bastion, of exploration, really. And, there was a heavy science focus with particularly the expeditions of Scott and Shackleton and Hillary. I think in the case of Borchgrevink, it was more around, I think there was potential for sort of mineral, mining and that kind of thing. Well, that's what they sort of hoped for. But they all had this real science focus. And I suppose wanting to understand a bit more about the impact that those regions have on the world as a whole.
Mm. And I was wondering, we kind of touch on climate change a lot here at on the Green Desk, as it kind of affects everything at the moment. I was wondering, have you seen, is there much impact on the buildings or the environment down there where you guys look after?
You'd have to speak to the conservators, really, because they're sort of the ones that are, working up close and personal with the buildings. But I know just the environments themselves, even outside of the effects of climate change, they're just such a harsh place. The artefacts inside, were starting to suffer from corrosion and things, and snow and ice buildup, causing sort of increased humidity in the huts, and creating all sorts of issues for the artefacts inside. So, in terms of climate change itself, I wouldn't be able to answer that, I'm afraid.
Mm. Well, that's all right, 'cause the real question I'm really interested in is about this Inspiring Explorers program, because it sounds like it's you're going places that you just generally wouldn't really go before. So this only started a couple of years ago, I think, the 2015. How did it come about, and who are the kind of people that are going on this these adventures?
Well, I suppose it came about, I guess, our goal is to connect young people with this legacy of exploration. And obviously, like you say, it's not a place that everyone gets to go in their lifetime. So we sort of wanted to try and give as many people as possible the opportunity to, explore these regions, and then share those stories, their experiences down there, with as many people as possible, and kind of I guess, yeah, share that legacy of exploration.
Been lucky enough to go down to the Antarctic?
Not yet. Got my fingers and toes crossed. Maybe one day, but no, I haven't been myself. But yeah, it's certainly definitely on the wish list. I've obviously read a lot about those early explorers during my time here at the Trust, and yeah, they're just pretty remarkable stories. But yeah, we've led this expedition that we're in the process of getting applications for at the moment is our fourth expedition. So yeah, the first one was in 2015. We crossed South Georgia Island, sort of marking the centenary of the first crossing by Sir Ernest Shackleton and two men on his expedition. And I'd encourage people to look up that story of the Endurance Expedition if you haven't already, because it's an incredible survival story. Following that, we summited Mount Scott on the Antarctic Peninsula, and then earlier this year led a 560-kilometre crossing of the Greenland Ice Cap, and that was honouring the legacy of Fridtjof Nansen, who first crossed the Ice Cap 130 years ago. So, yeah.
Wow. And so this upcoming one, the cut-off date for entry is...
Yeah, so we're calling on people for applications at the moment with a cut-off midnight this Sunday, the 30th of September. And basically applications are open to New Zealanders age 18 to 30. And yeah, I just really encourage people to put your hat in the ring for it. You never know.
Yeah, so how long is this one? It's fair, like 3 weeks or something, isn't it?
It's sort of 14 days all up, including kind of travel time on either side to get to the peninsula. It's a 10-day expedition itself, and it gives people the opportunity to explore the peninsula, see the wildlife up close. There'll be opportunities to kayak through Antarctic waters with an Olympian, Mike Dawson, he's an Olympic kayaker, and he's kind of going to mentor people on the expedition. And there's just a sort of a chance to learn about that history and the sort of science and the work going on down in Antarctica.
So this is truly like a one in a lifetime kind of opportunity. Can anyone do this? Like I'm fairly fit. I wouldn't say I'm exceptionally fit.
I'm probably in the same boat as you. Pun intended. But yeah, I think really as long as you've got it kind of a moderate level of fitness. And as long as you've had some experience in a kayak, we obviously don't want people heading down that have never sat in a kayak before. But yeah, unlike the previous expeditions, this is kind of open to more, I suppose, more people. I certainly couldn't have crossed the Greenland Ice Cap on skis, but I think I'd be pretty comfortable kayaking in Antarctica. So yeah, I think we sort of really, it's just about having a moderate level of fitness, and I guess just having a bit of resilience as well, because it's very cold down there, as you know.
Yeah, so definitely if you want to check out and go to the Antarctic, I'll put the link up on the website.
www.inspiringexplorers.com has all the information on how to apply.
That was the Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihei Modi Ora.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for another Tuesday. Thanks to everyone that came on today. We had Ethan Alderson Hughes, Hemi Kelly, Agnes Chow, Kenneth Chan, and James Harding. Thank you also to all of my producers, Jack, Connor, and Justin. Up next is The 1-4 with Jin. We'll catch you next week.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.